Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
You are listening to the Women's Podcast, brought to you by Green and Black's Organic Chocolate. Discover a different kind of dark. Welcome back to the Irish Times Women's Podcast. I'm Roisin Ingle. Our big news, which I've told you about before, but, you know, going to repeat myself, we joined Instagram, so please go there at IT Women's Podcast and follow us and leave a message if you like. Hope you've all been out in the sunshine and enjoying the tiny little increase in freedom. There are some McDonald's open today, so there's a bit of news. And I hope you've been having some nice outdoor times with small groups of socially distanced friends. Do get in touch with us, whether it's on Instagram or on our email, thewomenspodcast@irishtimes.com, or on Twitter at IT Women's Podcast, and tell us what you've been up to and how you're feeling and how you are at this stage, because we do want to keep in touch with all your stories. Also, another bit of news that you might be interested in is that we've got another big night in coming up on Saturday, and it's at 8 o'clock this Saturday with the wonderful singer Lisa Hannigan. I know loads of you are going to want to join that. So listen, drop us an email and tell us why you want to see Lisa Hannigan on Saturday night, and we will hopefully be able to send few of our readers the Zoom link to join us on Saturday night. Email us on thewomenspodcast@irishtimes.com. Tell us why you want to see Lisa Hannigan, and hopefully we'll be able to get you there. I just want to mention one thing I saw in relation to how this pandemic is affecting women particularly. It's something we've been trying to highlight over the last couple of months, and two stories caught my eye, one in the Irish Times this week, which described how women's well-being has been significantly more harshly affected by the coronavirus crisis than men's, although, of course, men are suffering too. And these are, according to a report from the Central Statistics Office, which was published on Tuesday, and it found that women are more likely to be extremely concerned about their and someone else's health, more nervous about the future, significantly less satisfied with personal relationships, and more likely to be smoking more and eating more junk food than men. The CSO's Social Impact of COVID-19 story, April 2020, finds that one in four women, 27.6%, are extremely concerned about somebody's health compared to one in five men. Women are also more likely to report being extremely concerned about their own health and maintaining social ties than male respondents were. So, last month, three quarters of women said they felt very nervous at least a little of the time in the past 4 weeks, compared with 61% of men. The proportion of both men and women feeling downhearted or depressed at least a little of the time in the past 4 weeks has doubled since 2018. So they're quite stark sort of facts. And as I said, men are struggling too, but it is interesting to see how this is affecting women more. And in a British newspaper, an opinion writer was talking about learning lessons about coronavirus from previous health emergencies like Ebola, and that it's clear that humanitarian crises affect girls and young women the hardest. And she mentions issues like harassment, gender-based violence, and access to education, how they disproportionately impact girls during crisis times. But what's often overlooked are the consequences that these issues can have on girls' and women's mental health. We already know when girls don't have equal rights and opportunities, it directly affects their well-being. And in Britain, 40% of young women aged 14 to 21 say their mental health has deteriorated since lockdown. And I imagine if you've got young daughters, or indeed if there's people in that age bracket listening, which I know there are, so young women particularly are quite vulnerable at this time. It is Mental Health Awareness Week, and I think that's really important to talk about. There's lots of people close to me struggling. I've sometimes struggled myself. And it's just a reminder that we need to mind each other and appreciate that there are so many women whose already difficult lives have been made even more challenging at this time. I'm not sure exactly what we can do about it. I don't have all the answers, but I do know that talking about these things and sharing how we feel with people close to us and acknowledging it is always helpful. Now, what do we have for you today? Well, Jane Casey is one of several brilliant Irish women writing in the crime genre at the moment. And she joined me for a chat about her latest novel, The Cutting Place, which follows Detective Maeve Kerrigan, who's a very popular person in her books. She joined me from her home in London, where she lives with her kids and her criminal barrister husband. That comes in very handy for plot lines, I imagine. And she talked to me about crime, about lockdown, about feminism and loads more. Here she is, Jane Casey. Jane, thank you very much for coming on the Women's Podcast. What is lockdown life like in London?
Well, it's for me as a writer, I mean, I work from home anyway. So the big difference is making everyone else work to my schedule. I think my family are slightly in shock about how I work and what I do all day. So I'm trying to just kind of keep to the same sort of routine that I have usually. And my husband is off work and he's doing the bulk of the home education and exercising the children and all the rest of it. I'm finishing off a book at the moment. So I've promised him that once I've done that, then I will be available to do parenting. But at the moment, the book is coming first.
Excellent. Just as it should be. How is he finding the homeschooling and being the, it sounds pretty much like the full-time parent at the moment.
Yeah, you know what? He's absolutely brilliant. Like he hasn't complained at all. He's taking it in his stride. And I think like it maybe just suits his personality. You know, he's good. If you give him a task, he'll just do it. So that's what he's doing. But I know a lot of people are really struggling with it. And I do struggle when my children want to come and talk to me and I have to explain to them, no, I'm working. And I know it just looks like I'm sitting staring into space. But actually, this is how mummy does her job.
So it's educational for everyone. I saw a great sign, actually, I think it was on Twitter, of a person just said, mummy can't speak. It's a sign on a door. And then it's like, if it's about this, here's the answer. It's all these different multiple choice kind of possible answers for your question. So that might be a way to go.
Definitely. And also they're definitely like they have adapted to the routine. So I know at like 11:05, somebody will say, mummy, can I have a snack? Like, I know that's guaranteed, no matter what else is going on. Their internal clock is definitely working the whole time.
And listen, what's the level of compliance like in London? Are you hearing it's different from, say, what you're hearing from family in Ireland? Or what's your observations from that point of view?
I think, like, for me, it's been really interesting because I get a lot of my news from Ireland. I watch RTE online. I get the Irish Times, and I'm definitely kind of connected in Ireland in a way, even though I'm in London. That I think a lot of people wouldn't necessarily be here. Like they wouldn't be people in London wouldn't be aware of what's happening in Ireland, and yet for anyone who is, it was almost like this kind of those two different narratives. And the messaging in Ireland is so clear and so kind of comprehensive and caring. And here there's a lot of confusion. There's a lot of people arguing over kind of things that sort of don't matter at the moment, but they also do. Like who said what when and who should be doing what. Locally, people have been amazing. And actually, I think there are some real positives to take out of the fact that people are helping one another and getting to know their neighbours a bit better. And, you know, I just hope that at the end of all this, we kind of look back and go, well, actually, we all learn something from that.
Yeah, no, I think there's a lot of learning to be done, definitely. Your work ethic doesn't seem to have been diminished by your lockdown anyway. It sounds like you're just getting the head down. I mean, you are quite prolific. This is your 9th book, The Cutting Place, in the Maeve Kerrigan series anyway. And that's like a book a year since the first one came out. How do you maintain that?
Fear. I'm frightened of deadlines, and I love writing, and I'm very lucky. I know I'm massively privileged to get to do this for a living, so I kind of I try not to complain about the deadlines and the writing aspect of things. And also, every time I finish a book, every time a book comes out, I get messages from readers saying, I really enjoyed it. When's the next one coming? So there's always like, they don't even wait for a second message. That's what I always get from people, which is lovely. Like, that's what you want writing serious fiction. You want there to be that hunger and that enjoyment of your characters. And it's just, it can put a little bit of extra pressure on.
Well, before we get back to Maeve Kerrigan, I should ask you, I know that you moved home briefly for a little while. It didn't really work out. And then you moved back to London again. Have you had any thoughts about whether you'd prefer to be locked down in Ireland or London?
I'd massively prefer to be locked down in Ireland for all the 2 kilometre journeys from your home and everything else, for all the restrictions. I really miss home, and I'm very conscious of the fact that I can't even go and kind of look through my parents' window and wave at them. So that's something that's really hard. And like, the emotional aspect of all of this, like, you can get very caught up in the practical side and in doing your work, and you can distract yourself. But actually, it's a really horrible situation. And I do miss being at home. And I think I'm so proud to see the way Irish people are handling it, and the way that, you know, there's just a community effort. And you have a real sense of kind of national pride that I think is lacking maybe here. And that's, you know, you want to go home. When something like this happens, you really want to be at home. So it is a bit of a shame to be here instead.
Well, you're managing it well. But listen, back to Maeve Kerrigan. Tell us a bit about her for people who haven't read the series and maybe are discovering you for the first time. You have legions of readers, but obviously new ones coming on board all the time too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is the thing. Like, a lot of people they come in at this point and they're like, oh, 9 books. I'm not sure that I have the headspace for 9 books to catch up. But the first thing is, I would say, I always write every book for the new reader, so that they can come in and say, oh, you know, do I like this character? Am I interested? And that they don't have masses to catch up on. Like, it's kind of given to them, so they understand what's happening. So Maeve is, she is a London Irish detective in the Metropolitan Police. So her parents are Irish. Her parents kind of come into a lot of the books. They would sort of make little cameo appearances. And she has been brought up almost like an Irish child, but in London. So she has this kind of dual identity, and maybe that makes her a little bit of a misfit, which I think is really helpful as a detective, that you want someone who is not necessarily someone who belongs automatically. But somebody who feels a little bit insecure and a bit of an outsider actually makes a very good detective, because they're always analysing what other people are doing and saying, and they don't take things for granted. So Maeve is, she's a complex character. She is very brave. She asks a lot of herself, and she has a very warm heart, I would say. And I think that comes across in this book in particular, in The Cutting Place.
And where did the inspiration for her come from?
I really wanted to write about how different the two cultures are. Like, that's something that I'm so conscious of. Like, I've been in London on and off since 2003, and it still feels like a very odd place. And it still feels, I think Irish people have a much better grasp of how English people are than English people do in reverse, maybe because we're sort of exposed more to English culture. I don't know, but there's definitely there's a gulf between the two cultures, and I really wanted to kind of explore how somebody would manage mixing those two together. And also that she's an attractive young woman in a very sexist environment in the police. And I do, like, I really wanted to write, I'm interested by the challenges that women have specifically in whatever they're doing. So for her, you know, she has to deal with a lot of other people's assumptions about her before she even gets to do her job. So that was something I really wanted to write about.
Well, tell us about The Cutting Place, because she's basically investigating some elite gentlemen's clubs, which is an interesting area to get into. The research must have been very interesting.
Well, I mean, there's, I think, probably the most overtly feminist of all of the books. Like, I think, you know, I have no problem with being called a feminist and being a feminist. That's fine. Like, I don't think it's a bad thing to be at all. But this is one where it definitely, it sort of comes to the fore, because the people that she's dealing with are the worst kind of men. They are very wealthy. They're very privileged. And they just think they can buy their way out of any situation that they find themselves in. So the book begins with the discovery of some body parts on the banks of the Thames in the centre of London. And they turn out to belong to a journalist, a young woman called Paige Hargreaves. And she has been investigating a particular gentleman's club called the Chiron Club. And in the course of her investigations has run up against some very unpleasant people. So Maeve is sort of following in her footsteps, trying to work out what she found out and trying to work out why someone might have wanted to kill her because of what she found out, or if there's another story there.
Okay. And did you have to go to a lot of gentlemen's clubs to make sure you got all the finer details right? And were you let in?
Well, you know, there are a few gentlemen's clubs in Dublin, and I've been in a couple of them, and they are very gracious establishments. They are very, like, we're not talking about, you know, we're talking about the clubs on Stephen's Green. We're not talking about kind of back alleys. They're very dignified places. I wouldn't say that they were exactly the same as the Chiron Club, which I fully invented. But then, you know, a couple of years ago, there was the news story about the President's Club, which was a club of businessmen. And they would have this gala dinner every year in London and have celebrity performers. And they behaved appallingly. And I think that was where the seeds of the Chiron Club came from for me. That this I think we've all encountered men like that who just think that, you know, they don't have values themselves. They just have money. So they can use their money to make everything go away if they need to. So that was what I really wanted to write about.
This podcast is brought to you by Green and Blacks, a rich, smooth and truly delicious chocolate experience.
And you mentioned your feminism there. Does it feel like now was the right time for a book that kind of was more overtly looking at that and the treatment of women and misogyny and sexism?
Yeah, I mean, I think... I'm always interested in it. And I think, like, part of the inspiration for this book was the murder of a Swedish journalist called Kim Wall in 2017. She was, people might remember her because she was murdered on a submarine by a man that she had gone to interview. So off the coast of Copenhagen, she was murdered in circumstances that we still don't really know about, but he has been convicted of her murder. So that was how she died. But what struck me about that story was that because she was a freelance journalist, she had to go and get the story before she could have the support of a newspaper or a magazine or, you know, an editorial backup for her. So she was very much on her own. And she was worried about that, that she had to go and do these kind of investigations and then do the work and then bring it to someone. To have the kind of support that maybe journalists used to get from their media organization, like people would know where they were, they would know who they were talking to. And it just occurred to me that these are the unintended consequences of things like the change in the way that media is absorbed now, that freelance journalism of that sort where you're investigating might become just too dangerous for young women to do. Like that, even despite the fact that they might have opportunities and they might have ideas, that they just actually wouldn't be able to do it because it's not safe for them, in the same way that women generally don't go out jogging late at night because, you know, if you just wouldn't take that particular risk. So I really wanted to kind of, that was sort of a starting point for me. And then I also wanted to write about privilege and men and to write a story that, to come up with a story that I think a young female journalist would find compelling enough to take risks to investigate. So it felt like the right thing to write. It felt like, I think often crime fiction gets tagged as being not particularly feminist. Certainly crime on TV has been challenged for being all about dead women and, you know, women being used as an aspect of a story that, you know, they're not really the focus of the story. That's not what this is at all. And I think there's obviously part of me that wants to say that, you know, that there's a good reason for this to happen this way, and that actually it's drawing attention to aspects of the world that maybe people aren't aware of or would rather not know about.
You're also involved in something called the Killer Women Collective, which is a brilliant title, whoever came up with that. Tell us about that and why it's important in terms of building the community of women who write the kind of books that you do.
We have about 20 members. We're all female crime writers. We're all based in the UK at the moment. We're sort of looking at having some satellite memberships around the place. But they are... There's power in numbers, so we can do a lot more together than we can on our own. So we run a festival every year. We're running a mentorship scheme for new writers who are of low income or of a minority background, because they're very poorly represented in crime fiction at the moment. And it's just a way of gathering together to kind of do some good in this genre. I think... crime is actually really well, has always been very kind to women. If you think about like the big female crime writers, they're still being read today. People like Agatha Christie is being read. A lot of her male contemporaries are well forgotten, and possibly deservedly so. But like, women have always thrived in the world of writing about crime. And The Killer Women is one of the things that we want to do, is to bring more people into that and to create more opportunities. So it's a very positive thing to have. Very often, like, I have seen panels of male writers and no female writers, or one female writer when you do book events, and they get shouted down very often. It's kind of hard to have your voice heard sometimes, just because men are louder, often just genuinely louder, not because they're deliberately trying to shout you down, but they just have more volume and they have more confidence and they hit the audience quicker than you do. So having a team of women behind you is actually a great help, and being able to set up festivals that work for all the participants is really important.
You know, you talk about that kind of male domination in some ways. In other ways, there's a lot of amazing, successful women writing crime books. Did you ever consider writing your books under a male pseudonym? That might be something you would do.
No, I never. It never occurred to me. I think maybe the kind of books that I write are so strongly about a female character that I don't think it would help to sort of neutralize my persona. I think maybe if I was writing something like a really high-tech thriller that we associate more with male writers, maybe it would come up then. But I think there's no hardship in being a female writer in crime. And actually, I know a lot of male writers who have a neutral identity or even a female pen name to pursue their career, because they feel uneasy about writing about some of these things as men. Even though they're very sensitive and very good writers, but I think they feel that they would rather not be in the foreground as a man writing about this stuff.
As a crime writer, are you someone who listens addictively to those true crime podcasts? I have friends who seem to be under this lockdown listening to a lot more of that kind of stuff. I personally don't get it, but it seems to be a thing. Are you into them?
I'm totally into them. I'm sorry. I'm absolutely obsessed. I love it. I love there's the two different kinds: one where you're being told a fascinating story, and the other where there's an actual active kind of investigation, and you get really drawn into it, and things change week on week. I think the classic was Serial. It was the first one that really, really hit the mark in that way. I just love them. I love thinking about crime. I find it compelling. I find it fascinating. And I don't know why, particularly in lockdown. Maybe it's just that it's a good distraction for us, because it is so absorbing.
Yeah. Have you got any ones that you'd recommend for people?
I love the West Cork podcast, which is on Audible.
See, I say I'm not into them, but then I really liked West Cork. And then the other one in Australia, I really liked that one too. What was that one?
The Teacher's Pet.
Yes, I love that.
That is a phenomenal effort. And again, like, I love that as they were making it, it changed, because they were drawing in, you know, people would call them up and say, actually, I was there and I remember that. I've never spoken to anyone about this, but now I'm prepared to tell my story. I mean, that's electric.
Yeah. Is there any other ones at the moment that we might not have heard of that you're aware of?
I'm listening to a lot of Canadian true crime. So there's a massive, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation do some fantastic investigations and podcasts. And I'm really enjoying listening to some of those. There's a great one about a town where people were accused of satanic rituals unjustly. And there was a whole kind of moral panic about it, a satanic panic, if you like. And that's fascinating to listen to.
What's that one called?
It is literally called Satanic Panic. And the podcast is Uncover. So it's a whole series called Uncover. And they do a different Canadian story. But Canadian crime is fascinating.
Tell us about the book you're currently writing.
So the book I'm currently doing is a standalone, which means that it's like not part of the series. It is about a young female barrister called Ingrid, who is aware that somebody is trying to kill her, and she has to turn to one of the worst people she's ever met in her life in order to save her own life. One of her ex-clients comes to her rescue, but whether she can trust him or not is another question.
Okay, and your husband is an actual real-life barrister, so have you been getting a lot of inspiration from his colleagues? Should they be worried?
No, I have to say, a lot of female barristers have kindly talked to me about their work and why it's different from his work. And again, like, there's a whole cultural thing to explore there about how women behave at the bar and how the kind of threats that they might be under from the people that they have to be with. There's quite like an intimate relationship. If you're representing someone, you can be shut in a cell with them under court, talking to them face to face after they've just had like the worst news they could possibly have. And for a woman to be in that position, there's a kind of a vulnerability there. Again, like, it always, these are the themes that keep coming up for me again and again, is, you know, why is it different for women to do this job? What is the thing that makes it difficult for them that they have to overcome before they even start doing the job?
And when will you be finished that, and you'll be back being a homeschool teacher and giving your husband a bit of a bit of time to himself?
Yeah, he's doing Skype hearings at the moment. So he has to dress up his top half as barrister and then his bottom half as running kit. So that's how he's living his life. I should be finished it in a week, but I keep saying that and then adding another chapter.
Okay. So you might get through this whole thing without having to actually put on your mortarboard or do any giving out to people over a kitchen table, which I've actually abandoned my homeschool now. I've decided I can't do both. I can't work from home and also be a teacher. So I'm letting them, they have all the materials, and I'm letting them be responsible and do what they need to do. And that's all I can do.
That's great. Like, I think that's what they need. I think children really thrive when they have a little bit of boredom and a lot of opportunity, and they'll probably come out with something amazingly creative at the end of it, and far more creative than they would if you were doing your daily homeschooling. This is how I'm selling this to my husband anyway.
I just feel like I'm just more interested in keeping the peace and having a happy house and feeling that we're all together and that that's a nice experience. I just would be terrible if they came to the end of this and what they remember is me shouting from my bedroom down at them to shut up, which has happened quite a lot. So
my lockdown motto is everyone fed and nobody dead.
Oh my God, that's brilliant. That's a great note. Such a crime writer.
Everyone fed and nobody dead. Yes, we should all embrace that. Jane Casey, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And that's it for today. Thanks to my guest, Jane Casey. And remember, please do get in touch with anything you'd like us to cover. You can go to Instagram at IT Women's Podcast. That's the same address for Twitter. And you can also email us on the Women's Podcast at irishtimes.com. You can subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Spotify, Acast, and all good podcast apps. And we always appreciate some feedback. So if you want to give us a review there on iTunes as well, that would be great. The podcast is produced by me, Roisin Ingle, and by Suzanne Brennan, with JJ Vernon on sound. Until next time, stay safe, and thanks very much for listening.
Hold up. Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.